The story of cruelty towards refugees in Australia is increasingly well known. More and more people are hearing about the men and women still being held by the Australian government for more than 8 years. But far fewer people know that the vast majority of people held in this country's detention centres, in Mita in Melbourne, Baita in Brisbane, Villawood in Sydney, Yonga Hill in Perth and elsewhere, have lived nearly all their lives in Australia, made homes, held down jobs and had families. Yet many of these people have been held in detention for years and many have no foreseeable prospect of release or even deportation. Detainees have fewer rights than prisoners and, importantly, have no idea of their release date. It's literally a case of people being locked up and the key being thrown away. This episode looks at the enormous power that the Immigration Minister holds over people's lives, thanks to Sections 501 and 116 of the Migration Act. Today I'm talking to three people. Joey Tangaloa Tawali and someone we'll call John are 501 detainees in the Mita Detention Centre in Broadmeadows in Melbourne. And Ian Rintoul is a long-time refugee activist, a member of the Refugee Action Coalition in Sydney and a member of Solidarity. Just to note that this episode includes mentions of suicide. If you need support, the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity. We're a revolutionary socialist group in Australia, and if you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naam or Melbourne. My first guest today is Joey Tangaloa Tawali. Joey is a 501 detainee in the Mita Detention Centre in Melbourne. Hello, Joey.
How are you going there, David?
I'm good. Now, Joey, first up, do you want to tell listeners a bit about yourself and your life?
You know, I came here, as far as I know, I was 3 months old. So we migrated from Tonga. Mum, dad, two brothers and a sister. And we came here in 1975. And I've been here pretty much the whole time. I went to primary school here in Ringwood Primary School. I went through Ringwood High School. And then in about year nine, I went back to Tonga for a couple of years, back and forth though. I would go over there, do some school, and then come back. That went on for a couple of years. But other than that, pretty much my whole life has been, I've been here in Australia. I have 12 children. My firstborn, she's in the Faulkner Cemetery. And that was in 1995. She was born, passed away. I have 11 other children. I have one granddaughter at the moment. And I'm expecting two more grandchildren this year, one in April and one in August. And pretty much I work, David. Like I say, I work here as well. And then when I hit probably early 20s, I joined some bike clubs. And that's where my life led me, into that area of hanging out with bikies and becoming part of that world. Yeah, and then I ended up going to prison. I served over 8 years. There was a bikie thing where my friends' children had been threatened by certain members of a bike gang, and I took the law into my own hands. And later found myself in prison. And from prison, I found out that I was the 501, which is the 501 legislation, which brought me to here where I am now. And that is the cancellation of a permanent visa. Well, pretty much I didn't know that I was a permanent visa. I always thought that I was an Australian citizen. And I always thought that permanent visa, Australian citizen, is the same thing. We have exactly the same benefits, we pay taxes, so all those sort of things, I thought I was Aussie, and being growing up in this Australian society has pretty much what's made, you know, that's what made me. The minister says that, oh, you know, it's all in, you know, you're Tongan. But I didn't learn any of this in Tonga. Everything I know, I learnt here in Australia. And I've said it many times before that I'm a product of the Australian society. And if I was ever going to represent a country or whatever, it would be Australia, you know.
For a citizen, if you do the crime, you do the time, you do the time, you come out and there might be probation or supervision, but you're back with your family. So for you, obviously, the situation turned out quite differently.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and for myself and many other 501s and 116s. So what happened is, yeah, when you do the crime, yeah, and you are not an Australian citizen, whether you've been here for 20, 30, 40, whatever, how many years you've been here, you're automatically, if you've done, I know they say that the legislation states that if you do 12 months or more, that your visa gets cancelled. But there are people here that haven't done any prison at all. There are guys here that have just been affiliated to certain OMCGs or things like that, you know, that are here. So, and there are guys that have never done any prison that are here. And basically due to the character tests that they have. But for me, like I say, being a 501 is double jeopardy. I feel like, so not only did I serve, you know, almost 8.5 years, I also now get out and come straight to a detention centre where the minister says, you know what, if Tonga does not want you, we are going to lock you there indefinitely. And that law was passed last year that you can, yeah, you, they can keep us here for as long as they like.
And how long have you been in Mita so far?
So far in Mita, I've been here now, I believe, 10 months now. 10 months I've been here in Mita. So I come here in March. March 2021.
And yeah. Of course, as a lot of people have realised with the tragedy in Tonga, with the volcano and the tsunami, and one of the things that many of us have discovered is that Tonga has no COVID, and the Tongan government is not even allowing New Zealand or Australian military personnel to enter the country with aid. And that's why you're in Mita, because Tonga won't take you back. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So what I'm led to believe is that Tonga refuses to take anyone from Australia or New Zealand. The fact being that they're worried about COVID, because if COVID was to hit Tonga, it would probably wipe the island out, being a population of 107,000. And also, my daughter has reached out to the Tongan consulate or Tongan embassy in Canberra many times, and they just basically say, look, we do not know how long it will be before Tonga opens. And I know last year they were saying, look, Tonga's not going to open for a long time. So, you know, once again, part of that for me is that, you know, I've done my time. I did the crime, done my time. Now I could sit here for years and many, many years. Basically, you know, why can't I go back to my family here in Australia? And I know I've mentioned before to my lawyer, you know, why can't I just get an anklet? Or also, why can't I sign on at a police station every day? I'd wear an anklet for the rest of my life. I just feel that basically, you know, what's happened to us is, you know what, you guys have got, there's something wrong with you, being ex-criminals, and we're going to give you a life sentence.
And you mentioned at this point that the Australian government isn't going to free you into the community. The Tongan government won't take you back for the foreseeable future. So it's, as you say, it could be years of sitting there in Mita waiting for something to happen. You've got people around you who have actually done many, many years in Mita and in the detention centre. Are you able, without identifying people, are you able to tell us a little bit about some of those situations?
Yeah, so some of the guys here, you know, all from all different nationalities. And when I say nationalities, look, some of these guys came here as refugees and, you know, settled, you know, in society out there in Australia. been out there for 20, 30 years. You know, another guy had come from Lebanon, been all his life, you know, been here for over 50 years. And they've been stuck here. So they did their time, and they've come here and been stuck here 5, 6, 7 years. It's just a shame. And the same thing, you know, these guys have mentioned the same thing. We'd be happy to wear an anklet. Just let us return home to our families. And everyone here feels like we've just been shafted. Like, and really no explanation why, besides, well, you went to prison for more than 12 months. Mm-hmm. You know, you're a threat. They say we're a threat to Australian society. I mean, but really at the end of the day, there's no difference between us, what we did, and any other Australian citizen that commits a crime.
That uncertainty, the fact you don't know whether you're going to be there for another month, another year, or for how long, it's similar to the situation to refugees, the Medivac refugees who are locked up in the Park Hotel prison in Carlton, and similar situation for refugees locked up in Baita, which is the Brisbane equivalent of Mita, and also in Perth. And I know with refugees that one of the biggest problems is not knowing whether you'll be free tomorrow or next year or in 10 years' time. And that's what destroys people's mental health. I'm assuming many 501s face the same sort of challenge. What have you been seeing around you in Mita?
So what I've seen here, yeah, when I first come here, I thought, wow, you know, I'm here now. I'm a very positive person. And when I got here, the aura that I got off people here was just negativity, just a dark aura of, you know, people were miserable. People still are. I try and do my best every day to cheer people up. And I tell them, you know, don't give up. But whatever happens, you know, whether you get deported or you don't, you get your visa back, just got to be strong. But I've seen people here sort of try and commit suicide in front of me. You know, just the mental health where guys, they're going crazy in here. You know, it's hard to explain, but it's almost like this joint has become a psych ward, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, guy, like you can tell, you know, the aura of men here, you know, it's not that, oh, you know, hey, how you going? Good morning, good to see you. It's nothing like that. It's like, it's just miserable. It's it just a lot of negativity in the air. It doesn't help when Serco officers talk down to people. One of the things that I get upset about here is how they talk down to some of these 501 guys here. And, you know, like, I think they think, oh, you know what, this is how we treat refugees, and then they come along and they treat us the same way. And I believe that that's how they treat refugees. They talk down to them, they look down at them, and it rubs off on us. So when I say us, it rubs off on the 501s. What they don't realise is, hang on a minute, eh? You know, and no disrespect to the refugees, but we've been here a long time. You know, and so we understand too what the refugees are going through. And in some parts of Mita, refugees mingle with 501s, and the guys do say that 501s, they get treated like mugs. You know, Serco officers talk down at them, disrespect them, don't really tend to their needs. And there is also Serco officers here. For example, they have Indians, Pakistanis, I think some Afghans. Some of these Serco officers, you think being of different heritage would have a little bit of a heart, you know, but it's not the case. It's almost like they put that uniform on and go, you know what, these are refugees, we're Australian citizens. If they are Australian citizens, they probably don't even have that. They're probably permanent visas or working visas.
You've told me previously that it's actually life in prison is better than life in Mita. And part of that is what we've already discussed, that if you're doing a prison sentence, you know when the end date is, you know when your release date is coming up. But tell me about some of the other things that you think, amazingly, make prison a better place than a detention centre?
In prison, for example, if you have any medical issues, mental health issues, they are addressed ASAP. The last thing prison, what they want is prisoners to riot or prisoners, you know, or someone suiciding in prison. That's absolutely a big no-no. They don't want any of that. So in prison, they tend to every need you have. But here, it is designed. So here in MITRE, it is designed to break you down. Everything is request forms. If you have, like I've mentioned before, if you have a headache, they ask you to put in a request form and someone will come see you. That request form goes in a box and sits in that box till the next crew come on. They then take that probably the next day, hand that to the medical staff, which then they have to sift through it and takes another day. So by the time it actually gets to someone who will write it out and say, all right, let's prescribe this person Panadol, it's been 2 or 3 days. In some cases, weeks. And same again with mental health. In prison, if you have a mental health issue and you're feeling suicidal, they will grab you straight away, sit down with a counsellor or a psychologist, psychiatrist, address your situation, put you in a padded cell and give you the attention you need. In this place here, they tell you, look, there's nothing we can do for you. Fill out a form, a request form, and hopefully a psych will come and see you in, you know, tomorrow. There's absolutely nothing like that. Also, in regards to just little things that you ask to clean, you know, they don't give you these, you know, like, for example, I asked for a scrubbing brush to scrub my shower. You have to ask the cleaners, and that cleaner has to be there at a certain time. And, you know, then the cleaner has to be there while you use it. And when you finish, you've got to give it back to the cleaner straight away. So again, it's just everything here is like a handball situation. Whereas in prison, it's addressed straight away. Living conditions are poor. The food here is terrible. There's so many things I could cover, David, but you know, yeah, absolutely so many things. But the biggest things are mental health, medical. Even for a razor blade, here in prison, you can buy razor blades at the canteen. You can take them back and have them with all your property and things. But here in MITRE, you have to go up, ask for the razor blade, they give it to you, and you have 1 hour to shave and whatever you got to do, and then give it, return it. Things like that. You know, going up and asking them for toilet paper, they give you a couple of rolls here and there. In prison, everything's there. You know, they give you like maybe 10, 15 toilet rolls. That covers you for the week. Come back once a week. Again, back to medical. Samra packs, which are weekly packs. It frees up the staff. So you go up there once a week and get your medical pack. Here, we've asked so many times to give us the medical pack. So many guys aren't even going up every day to get their medication that they're supposed to. Get medication. I'm one of them. I only go up maybe 2 or 3 times a week. It's just too much hassle. Going up there, it's just a hassle because they've always got different staff on. And I believe that some of these staff are just trainees. So, but everything that goes here on here in MITRE and detention centres around Australia are designed to break you down so you can sign. That's how it is. And I've had this discussion with Australian Border Force here. I said, so you're telling me that nothing will change? And they have said to me that if you ask me these same questions in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, and you'll get the same answer. So basically what they're saying is conditions here will never change, never improve. This place is not a place for you to come here and get comfortable. That's how it is. And it came out of Australian Border Force's mouth.
And one of the things that adds to the pressure on detainees and on refugees in detention as well is the lack of visits, particularly family visits for 501s who, like yourself, you've got family here in Melbourne. You haven't had visits, am I right in saying, the whole time you've been in MITRE?
I was lucky to get in 2 visits back in 2021 in April, I believe it was, where it opened up for like maybe 3 weeks, and I got in two visits. I had visits with, I first met my granddaughter in one visit, and the following I had five of my children come in. But other than that, absolutely, there is no visits, and this is a big, big issue that is for everyone, refugees, 501s, 116s, people need to speak to people and see people. And the funny thing is, they have a COVID safe facility here, David. They have a COVID safe facility. It's all decked out nicely here that you can sit on one side. There's a glass or a bit of plastic in the middle, and that your family can sit on the other side. And these things, what surprised me is that workers come in here, there's coronavirus here now in pretty much all the yards. And when I say that, the officers that work in all the yards, they've got COVID. And what happens there is, like, it's okay for them to come in with and bring in COVID. Why is it not okay for our families to come in and do the same test that they do, which is that rapid test? Surely our families can come in, do the rapid test, and we have visits. But that is a massive, visits is a massive part of mental health, especially for guys here like myself, but there's guys here that have babies. And that's a big, big thing, you know, where they want to see the babies and things like that. So, but absolutely, David, absolutely massive, massive. The visits is causing massive, massive mental health issues.
And there were protests just back before Christmas, because obviously Christmas is a time when people are under even more pressure, probably feeling much, much worse. There are always big issues around Christmas time with mental health and domestic violence because of the pressure it brings. And the lack of visits led to protests in two of the compounds at Mitre. Tell me about the protests, and how did Serco respond?
So the protests began with, we had a meeting with the Australian Border Force. We had representatives from three compounds. So there was about six of us all up. So two representatives from each compound that was here. So that was Ford compound, Erskine compound, and Glenelg compound. So when we went to that visit, to that meeting, they said, look, with the visits, we don't know when they can come back. But what they've done in the past year is they've allowed guys that are getting deported during the COVID period to have visits with their family. So what we asked is, why can't we have the same thing and just give our families a rapid test or do the old temperature check? And they said, look, we'll look into it, but we can't guarantee it. But let us look into it and they'll get back to us. So on the Thursday before Christmas Eve, this Australian Border Force officer never came back to talk to the guys, which then got all the guys upset and all the guys all wound up, which then everyone decided that we're going to have a peaceful protest where we all sleep outside. Well, that peaceful protest began on Thursday and then went on to Friday, which is Christmas Eve, and went on to Saturday, which is the Boxing Day. And Boxing Night, Boxing Day evening, sorry, is when things erupted. But the lead up to the protest where it turned ugly is because they refused to give us anything at all. And when I say anything, I refer to, they weren't giving us any food. They weren't giving us any bread. When I asked them for bread, then it got to the point where we were asking for toiletries. Guys were asking for toilet paper, and they were refusing to give us toilet paper. That's where it escalated to, you're treating us like animals now. And look, I myself was one of those people that got upset, and many people got upset. And then that was their response to us sleeping outside, doing a peaceful protest, trying to get the media to pay attention. Their response was, give them nothing. And that's why it escalated to where it got to. And, you know, obviously there was property damage and things like that. But, that's what happened there in that case. And then the Serco ERT team came in, and there was...
Sorry, what, can you explain what that... ERT is?
So ERT is equivalent to, like, on the outside, you'd call them SOGs. So ERT are the team that come in, like I think there's also another name for it as a cat team.
Like a riot squad.
A riot squad, yes. Yes. So then the riot squad was brought out. There was police out the front. And probably at some point, maybe Sunday into the Sunday, it would have been. We sort of negotiated, cleaned up the compound, and they came back in and took control. But for those, for a good 2 weeks after Boxing Day, it was all murky waters. For example, we would ask for things, they wouldn't give us anything. Officers here too make some really smart ass comments. You know, for example, guys would go up there and say, "Oh, can I get this?" And they would say, "Oh, well, haven't you got it all? You just took everything." So there's officers here that egg on the situations. You know, instead of just keeping their mouths shut and go, you know, when guys come up and ask them for things, they either just say, "Oh, look like that, we don't have any," or "Come back later, I'll get it for you." They egg on the situation. They're provocative. And these are things that I can tell you now, a prison officer, if he's provocative in prison, he won't last in that prison for much longer, because other officers they'll remove him. Someone will say, "Oh, look, let's get rid of this officer." But here, it doesn't seem to be the case. Here, it's okay for them to be provocative, you know? When I see them, like I said, there's many times where I see them talk down to guys, and I think, like, how do they expect us to respect them if they've got no respect towards us, you know? And be respectful. How do they expect us to be respectful when it's not a two-way street? Everything here is a one-way street, you know? And I see the point of view too, where the government makes things like this, make it like this, is because they want us to break and sign to leave this country.
A couple of days after Christmas, some of us organised a rally outside the front gates of Mitre, and it was people from the Refugee Action Collective, of which I'm an activist, but also friends and family, not just of yourself, but of other detainees. And we heard from you and another guy or two guys, I think, and it was a speak out. We stood there in solidarity with you.
Yes.
What does that mean to people inside, whether a detainee or a refugee? You can't see us, you're a long way back, but when you know that people are outside there protesting for you, making a public fuss, what does it do for people's morale?
So what happened when that took place, David? Everyone was so thankful and grateful, and everyone here said, never ever has anyone protested for 501s ever. So all the people from Refugee Action Collective, David, we were blown away. And you know, the day that they just were at the front, there might have been 50 people, but everyone was like, "Wow, this is amazing. This is the first time anyone has ever done a protest." And they were even saying, guys here that were at Moorabbinong, they said, "No one ever went to Moorabbinong. No one has ever been to Moorabbinong and done this." So we were forever grateful, and we'll always be grateful that someone listened. I say it again, if this does not help me or some of us here, but if we can help people in the future, then we've made a difference. Because I believe that there will be a time that this law will be abolished. This 501 legislation and 116 legislation, it will come a time that this will be abolished. And I believe there will come a time that refugees, once again, will be given a status in the community. Because that's how it used to be. You know, they were here, you know, got all their paperwork ready and everything, and then bang, they were back, they were out there. You know, but for this law to come into place and be like this, I mean, I don't know really what politicians were thinking that supported this, you know? You know, and especially for the 501s being, we're Australian made. We are pretty much all products of Australia. You know, my life, as you know, David, is a colourful background. I was a president of three different bike clubs, but I did not learn this in Tonga. Everything I learned here in Australia. You know, growing up here, being here, you know, family here, everything I learned, I'm Australian made. Mm. And Australia, the Australian government take ownership and say, all right, these people, we're responsible for them because we created them. You know, even though I was born in Tonga, but Australia made me what I am today.
Yeah. Look, thank you, Joey, for being so honest and upfront. Can I ask you one last question? And in some ways, it's a tough question.
Yeah.
Most refugee supporters have never really thought about the situation for 501s. And I think a lot of refugee supporters would feel nervous about speaking up against the section of the Migration Act, Section 501 of the Migration Act, that sees you in detention today. Because by and large, people who are 501s have been, not all, as you say, but many have been found guilty of criminal activity. So what would you say to a refugee supporter who's a bit nervous about coming out in support of 501s, not of what people have done, but against the idea that people should be locked up, deported, and put through the kind of hell that you're put through? What would you say to a refugee supporter?
So what I would say is, please give us a chance. You know, we've done our time. A lot of us here are broken men, you know, and women who have done the time, done the crime. Maybe if people from the Refugee Action Collective and people that support refugees could just say, all right, let's have a look at the situation. And if there are people, depending on what your crime, like I said, I'm happy to wear two anklets and a bracelet even, and I'm happy to sign on every day. My days of living that life are long gone. And there is so many of us here that say the same thing. But I just look at it and, is it fair that we be locked up like this or deported? Is it really fair? That's what I ask people from that support refugees to consider it, what is fair and what is right. I do not think this is fair, and I do not think this is right, because what they've given us here, even though we've done our time, they've given us a life sentence. Whether it be remaining here for many, many more years or deported, we'll never hold our children again unless they come overseas. We'll never attend weddings. We'll never attend funerals. In my case, having 11 children here, I've been locked up for over 9 years. You know, 99 birthdays I've missed out on. Yeah, so my thing would be, please, guys, understand that a lot of us are rehabilitated. A lot of us are at pretty much the end.
Yeah.
Like, this is a fight for, this is a, like I said before, this is a cry. This is a cry out for help. Please help us. Please, can someone understand what is going on here is wrong. Yeah, what sums it up is we've been given a life sentence.
Yeah. And I think to add to that, I would say that the same immigration minister who has godlike powers over somebody like a tennis player like Djokovic or our friends in the Park Hotel prison down in Carlton has the same godlike power over you and your fellow 501s. The minister could decide tomorrow to give you back your visa and free you into the community, or could keep you there for years, or could kick you out of the country. And I think it's fundamentally wrong that a minister has so much power over people's lives, whether those people are so-called 501s or whether those people are refugees. It's the same rotten system, it's the same minister, it's the same Migration Act, and that's something I think we can all unite around.
Absolutely. And like I've said before, David, you know, we get it and we understand that you know, we did a crime, we've done the time. And we feel for the refugees that have never done any crime. And they've been here for example, Mehdi's been here from the age of 15, and he's 24 now. Where is the justice? Where is people saying, you know, this is not right? Someone, please look at this. Like, where are the politicians that are in Parliament really looking at these situations? These are the people that are going to make the difference. If politicians can stand up and look at this and go, hang on a minute, this is not right, and speak up about it, that's where it's going to make the difference, you know? With Refugee Action Collective making some more noise, this is how they're going to, it's going to open their eyes up to it as well. So
we'll keep up the fight, and we're going to keep on talking with you and protesting and speaking out on your behalf. So thank you for your time, Joey.
Thank you very much, David. Much appreciated.
My second guest today is another person detained at MITRE in Melbourne, also under Section 501 of the Migration Act. Let's call him John. Hi, John. How are you?
Hi, David. How are you doing?
I know that you have seen some really horrible things going on in your compound at MITRE in terms of contempt for people's health. Can you tell us about some of those situations?
Absolutely, David. Contempt is a rather soft word, but we'll go with it at the moment. There's a total lack of a duty of care. The powers that be here seem to, they cross their T's and dot their I's just to cover their backs and say, well, this is what we've done, but it basically amounts to nothing. Okay, one gentleman, he's 54 years of age, and he's been forced for 4 years now to climb up onto a top bunk. Poor guy fell off the top bunk trying to get down the ladder a few weeks ago, ended up in hospital. He's cracked his pelvis. He's had nothing except Panadol since. We have another gentleman, he's 39 years of age, who's been complaining of severe heart pains. He's also very, very short of breath, has to get up in the middle of the night, unable to breathe. He's been complaining of this for 3 months. He's yet to see anyone. The situation at the moment is probably more dire than it was originally, because we're at about 50% capacity of staff. So there is no doctor. There's nothing. Even myself, I had to wait 6 or 7 months before I got to see a dentist with severe toothache. And another gentleman here who's 58 years of age, he has been waiting 6 months also. He lost an enormous feeling out of one tooth, and he's been in excruciating pain, and he receives Panadol once a day. That's all. The poor guy was also assaulted 2 years ago, though. He was severely assaulted, and it's left him incapacitated, whereas with his back, he had back problems to start with, but it's been severely exacerbated, and he has had no treatment. There hasn't been a physio in here for a good 10 or 11 months. Another gentleman just really exemplifies the uncaringness of this place. Gentleman is 66 years of age, complained for 6 or 7 weeks of severe chest pains. His urine was black. It was like Coca-Cola. And they were giving him Panadol, which is the standard procedure here. The end of it, he basically had to threaten them with legal action if they didn't help him. He was taken to hospital, where he promptly died the next day. And they brought him back to life. And again, the day following, he died again. He was brought back, and he was eventually diagnosed with septicemia and severe infections in the kidneys and intestines. I guess, it doesn't get much worse than those things.
What do you put the contempt with which you and your fellow detainees are treated? What do you put it down to? How does the system look at people like you?
The system looks at us in a very, very poor light, obviously, otherwise we wouldn't be here. Like I say, it's funny, when I first came in here, I saw a sign on the wall, and it said, in Australia, you have the right to complain. So, if you've got anything to say, complain. I mean, that's what I'm talking about when I say they cross their T's and dot their I's, and if anyone said, complained about them, they'd say, well, no, they have a right to complain. But you can complain up the wazoo,
I know sometimes you feel like the government is treating you as if you're a terrorist. You're not a terrorist. Why do you feel like you're being treated like terrorists? How does the law allow this to happen?
Well, the law is, well, to say bizarre is a gross understatement. In 2014, you're probably aware of this, Mr. Morrison, who was the immigration minister at the time, or the Minister of Home Affairs, they brought in this, the 501 Act, and they made it retrospective. Usually when a new law is instituted, it's from that date on it applies. But they've made it retrospective, which means you can go back 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So if anyone has committed an offence and been sentenced to 12 months imprisonment or 12 months home detention or a 12-month good behaviour bond or had a 12-month sentence wholly suspended, so you wouldn't even have had to spend one day in jail, you're considered a bad character and then you are locked up. And it's like with myself, I spent 6 months in jail 26 years ago. And because of that, I'm deemed a bad character. And I've had my life basically taken away, absolutely taken away. And there's people, even like myself, that have been here 50, 60 years. And it just doesn't matter. I mean, a lot of people here have been here before Mr. Dutton or Mr. Morrison were even alive. Like, we're not considered Australians. I mean, the situation is even, can get even worse than that. There's people in here that have never been to jail, have never committed an offence, but purely by association, like there's several gentlemen in here that were with a bike group. And because the bike group's got such a bad name for political reasons, and so if you're associated with that, you've not committed a crime, you've not been charged, you've certainly not been convicted, you are taken out of the community and you are locked up, and they're trying to send you to a country that you've not been to for 20, 30, 40 or 50 years. It is absolutely bizarre. It's criminal. And I believe this is purely for political gain. And there is some sort of business attached to this, and as you would know, for the powers that be to spend, like in here, in Mita, it's $4,900 per day, per person. That's what it costs the government or the taxpayers. On Christmas Island, I believe it's $10,000 per person per day. And on Nauru, it's $4.5 million per person per year. And these people haven't committed offences. I mean, these poor refugees coming here, all they've done is wanted to go to a better, find a better life. And the government deems it necessary to spend $4.5 million per year to keep them incarcerated. It's bizarre. Is a gross understatement.
How old were you when you came to Australia?
I was 5.
Much older than that now. You've got family.
I'm 60 years older than that now, yes.
So you've lived your whole life here, but you face the possibility of deportation because of a crime you committed and time you did in jail more than 20 years ago. What do you think when you hear Morrison talk about Australian values? What do you think when you hear that?
Oh, it sounds good to the voters, I guess. But he is certainly not one to talk. I mean, the amount of fraud and corruption and criminal acts that the government perpetrates is just, you can fill volumes with it. I mean, right down to people like Christian Porter, who he was accused of rape, but no, we won't worry about that. His character's okay. Now, if that happened to a person who who'd been here for 50, 60 years on the outside and hadn't taken out Australian citizenship, that person would end up in here because you had an allegation against you. So all you have to have is allegations levelled against you. It doesn't have to be substantiated in any way, shape or form, and you will be taken away from your home, your family or everything and locked up, and the locking up is indefinite.
How long have you been in MITRE?
Nearly 2 years.
And do you see any end in sight?
At the moment, no. I mean, I was in the horrors when I first came in. Because people were saying it'll be a couple of months, and I'm thinking, oh my God, really, a couple of months? I haven't done anything wrong. there's people here that are, I mean, it's ludicrous. People these days, I mean, I'm sure the general public aren't aware that, but something so minor, it's like a guy just went to court over the last couple of days, and this is the AAT, and they said to him, they're making a big deal because he was caught using his mobile phone in the car. And they're bringing that up and saying that you're a bad character. You have no respect for Australian rules. I mean, this is insanity.
You'd have to lock up half of Australia if using the phone in the car was...
I think three quarters, David. Yes. I mean, who hasn't done that?
Is there anything else you'd like to add, John?
Just finally, when they talk about bad character. Now, Mr. Dutton has had many, many things over the years levelled at him. And if you using that as a criteria, well, you would lock him up. But because he's an Australian citizen, that doesn't happen. If it was anyone else had the sort of allegations levelled against him that he has, he would have his visa removed and he'd be locked up.
All right. Thank you for sharing some of that situation with us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome, David.
My final guest today is Ian Rintoul. Ian is an activist with the Refugee Action Coalition in Sydney and a member of Solidarity. So welcome, Ian.
Yeah, hi, Dave.
I was wondering if you could just take us through some of the twists and turns in the legal situation that both Joey and John have talked about. So we've heard about 501s, we've heard about 116s, we've heard about legislation changing in 2014. So could you step us through a timeline and what this all means?
Oh, okay. It is a very, very complicated area. So I think a lot of people do have great difficulties. But effectively, 501, I mean, the Section 501 has been there as long as the Migration Act, and that it provides for the minister to be able to cancel visas on the basis of criminal convictions. What happened in 2014 was that went from discretionary power, may cancel, to a mandatory power. So now, not only are there mandatory cancellations, but they've increased in a whole series of ways. The people who are caught by that mandatory cancellation. I mean, in particular, they've now people are being sentenced not necessarily consecutive periods, but even if they've had two or three convictions, the total of which amounts to 12 months in imprisonment, then they're caught by the by the mandatory cancellation provision now, and there's a whole steps of other ways. I mean, one of the things that people don't realise is that people who are convicted of crimes inside immigration detention, regardless of what they're, of any conviction inside a migration detention facility, their visas are mandatory cancelled, or the minister must refuse to grant a visa. So, I mean, that's why we are getting so many kind of asylum seekers or refugees who are also being caught by that provision. So that changed in 2014. That question of the mandatory cancellations and increasing both the scale and the range of people who are caught by the mandatory cancellation. Section 116 is really about the minister's power to cancel, and that's where, similar to what we've seen with the Djokovic, power, or the powers minister had to cancel Djokovic's visa, the whole that was also extended so that when the minister may refuse to grant, the ministerial power to actually assess the character, or the things that came up actually in Djokovic's case, sort of health, safety, good order of the Australian community, issues. But there, as we saw in the Djokovic case, the ministerial power is kind of on reasonable grounds may. So it means that it's a very, very fuzzy area, but it allows the minister to actually cancel visas when there hasn't been a conviction, just when he's got a reasonable suspicion or can reasonably conclude those kinds of things. So it does mean that many people are caught inside the detention facility without actually being convicted. And in some cases, even when the conviction when they've not been convicted, when they've only been charged, and they've either been found not guilty or in some cases the charge itself has been dropped, but the Section 116 power, overrides that, and they remain either with their visa cancelled or, without the grant of a visa.
And in fact, things nearly got even worse, didn't they? Because the coalition recently introduced a bill to toughen up the restrictions further. I think they were knocked back, but they were aiming to make it even easier to deport people.
And also to extend, the character provisions, the things that could be caught by the ministerial, discretionary powers. So, I mean, the government has really since 2014 has been systematically tightening that that element of immigration detention. So now it's more about 80% of people who are in immigration detention are 501s or 116s. They're not, asylum seekers, anymore, with the fact that the government has, effectively stopped the boats arriving in Australia. The vast majority of people in immigration detention are the category of people that we're talking about, the 501s or 116s.
And the numbers are exploding?
Yes, the numbers are increasing. I mean, it's another area that we've got an interesting investigation, because the overriding numbers in Australian detention remain about the same between 1,400 and 1,500, but there's about 40 people a month coming out of jails into immigration detention on the basis of the visa cancellation. So there's a really an unholy balance somewhere happening as the government tries to juggle and maintain the numbers. Presumably it's its contract with Serco is a part of that assessment about who actually is held after they are released from prison, where they end up in the immigration detention system. But it also means, and that when we've seen, we've seen this over the last couple of years, where the government has reopened Christmas Island as effectively for 501s that can't be contained inside the mainland immigration regime any longer. And we're getting to a point now where I think we will see in the next few weeks the likelihood that more people will actually be taken from Villawood and Maida, perhaps Yonga Hill, to Christmas Island, because their Villawood and Maida are at capacity, and with 40 people a month coming out of jails into the immigration detention system, they have to go somewhere. Either they're released or they will expand capacity at Christmas Island, and they've still got a bit of capacity that they could expand there. But that does mean that we're likely to see at some point in the not too far distant future a major detention facility on Christmas Island effectively become what it once was, the devil's island of Australia's detention system, entirely filled with 501s.
Finally, deportation. At the core of the idea of deportation is that there is something wrong with the individual, and that Australian society would be safer if that damaged individual was expelled elsewhere, wherever they can be got rid of, back to supposedly their home country. From a socialist point of view, how do we articulate opposition to that idea?
Well, I think one of the issues is of course, the overriding social responsibility. For many people, they're Australians. The question of whether they're are citizens or not doesn't alter the fact that they've grown up their whole life. They've been in Australia their whole life. They've been socialised in Australia, and in that respect, Australian society carries responsibility for faults or otherwise that these particular people have. But I think overriding that is I think the fundamental racist or nationalist quality of the ministerial cancellations. And there is a connection, although there's also sometimes been a tension between asylum seekers and refugees in detention and and 501s, when you it's increasingly, perhaps increasingly obvious that there is a connection between the the border politics of the the Liberal National governments over asylum seekers and what's happened over 501s. I mean, fundamentally the distinction is about whether people are citizens or or non-citizens, in the same way they try to use the border politics as, again, we've seen in the case of Djokovic this time, the tampering 2001 of trying to the LNP to actually pose as the question as border protection, as being the architects of of border protection. In the same kind of way, they use the distinction between citizen and non-citizen to pose as the protectors of of citizens, as if somehow or other non-citizens are not deserving of the rights that that citizens have. But I think for And I think in that respect, one of the it's part, I think, of just common common sense. I mean, most people, see it, the criminal justice system, as you do the crime, you do the time, and you're, that's the sentence, and you fulfil that sentence, and you get out. That's not the case for non-citizens, and I think it's very clear, that when there is discrimination on the basis of whether you're a citizen or a non-citizen, it does come down to a racial element, a nationalist element of and of discrimination and a persecution of people on on the basis of whether that people are a citizen or a non-citizen. I don't think that's something that, certainly not something a socialist accept. I don't think actually the vast majority of people don't accept that. I think people do think if you're in this society, there's one criminal justice system, it should apply to everyone equally, but this is another case where, rules, aren't rules.
Okay, thanks for your time today.
Yep, okay, thanks very much, David.